This week on The Vergecast, Allison Johnson, Dan Seifert, and Alex Kranz join the show. We talk about our Samsung Z Flip and Z Fold 3 reviews, Allison's Pixel 5a review, whatever is going on with Apple, Epic, and Google. Lots came out on that front this week, and Facebook's Metaverse for Work. That's coming up on The Vergecast now.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at Deloitte.com/US/engineering advantage.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to Vergecast, the flagship podcast of Platform Lock-In.
Ooh.
Every time you listen to our show, it gets harder to listen to a different show. That's everyone. They compound. We only work with certain brands of headphones. I'm Neil. I'm your friend. Dieter Bohn is here.
I'm your default HTTPS handler.
That's so much more accurate than you know. I don't know what that means. Alex Kranz is here.
I am your credit card processor.
Wow, you got some strict rules.
I am, yeah. Real strict.
Charging those rates. Dan Seifert is here.
Hi.
Good, Dan.
I don't have a quip. I wasn't ready. Nobody told me bring a quip.
We do the beginning of the show the same every week.
I've only done this like a decade. Nobody told me.
Allison Johnson is here. Hey, Allison.
Hello. I don't have a quip either.
You don't need one. Dan has much higher. He's been around for a longer time. All right. There's a lot to talk about. Allison, you reviewed the new Pixel 5a. We reviewed the Galaxy Watch 4, the Z Flip, the Z Fold. There's a lot of Z stuff. We have a pay into the Galaxy Note that we need to discuss. Then there's a tremendous amount of lawsuit news, basically. We got unredacted complaints in Google versus Epic. Lots to talk about there. There's Apple versus Epic news that just never stops happening. A lot to talk about this week on the Vergecast. I do, however, as always, want to start with COVID. We are in a very strange time in our COVID experience, our shared COVID experience that we've been going through for over a year, far too long now. We are in the midst of the Delta variant spike across the world. We are hearing more about breakthrough cases. Two senators today actually tested positive for COVID. They're both vaccinated, breakthrough cases. What I will remind you, breakthrough cases are vanishingly rare among the vaccinated, and you are much safer if you get vaccinated. So we have a story about the sort of certainty, the mathematical certainty that there will be breakthrough cases as more people get vaccinated, combined with Delta. I just remind and beg every week on the show, please get vaccinated. It does make things better. The vaccines are extraordinarily effective. But as you hear that news, we have some stories on how to contextualize it, how to understand it. On the same note, Biden administration announced, we started talking about this a bit last week, we all saw it coming, Biden administration announced booster shots will be available to Americans starting in September, starting with the elderly. The CDC said immunocompromised people should get a third shot if you were part of the two-dose vaccine. And then we have a deep dive. We keep talking about COVID as part as a systems problem, a data problem, a technology problem on why our public health data systems have not, even after all this time, been up to the task of helping us understand the data on COVID. So we're still in it. We get your shot. Eventually, we'll come out of it. Just hold tight. Here's what I'm looking forward to. We're going to have our birthday party in October. Lots of cool guests announced. People are coming. We're going to check vaccine statuses. I want to have that party. It's only going to happen. I want to have a 10th birthday party for The Verge in New York with lots and lots of people. It's only going to happen if vaccine rates go up, cases go down. Like, we're doing it. We're charging ahead.
Love it.
But everyone's got to help me out. I've been looking forward to that party for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Come on.
Don't mess up with the party, guys. Get vaxxed.
Please. Don't mess up my party.
Priorities.
I have a priority. I want to party. Get vaxxed. But also, it's safe and good. Do it.
Yeah, but also the other things.
Also the other stuff. Yeah.
Look, you gotta meet Americans where they are. All this high-minded stuff about public safety and health and dude, no. Do you want to rage? Get the shot.
Exactly. That's all I was thinking.
All right. Let's talk about phones. A lot of phones this week. Dieter, you wanna drive this one?
I think that the most interesting phone, but also like weirdly not, but is, but it's not. It's a dichotomy. It's a tale of opposites. Is the Pixel 5a? So Allison, you reviewed it. Am I weird to think that like this is at the exact same time fascinating and boring?
That's how I would put it. Yeah. Really, it's a real short list of updates. So on the face of it, it doesn't sound like much. So comparing to the Pixel 4a 5G, you get a little bit bigger screen. It's a 6.34 inch panel now. Mm. You get a pretty sizable battery boost, which has been like not the strongest point for Pixel phones in the past. And then you get IP67 waterproofing. And like, ta-da, that's it. But it's when you kind of step back and you look at all the pieces together, and it's really impressive. And it's cheaper this year. It's $450. And okay. I think the 4A 5G came out at $500.
So that's like what sounds boring on the face of it. But to me, what's interesting is you look at sub-$500 phones, and every phone has its gimmick, and it seems like the Pixel 5a's gimmick is we do everything you care about well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not flashy. It's like, it's kind of hard to market, I think.
Right.
But yeah, it's just a really good all-arounder, and there's really nothing you can fault it for. Like, it's not the biggest phone. You know, some people want a really huge screen. There's definitely budget phones out there that can do that. If you want a fast refresh rate screen, the Samsung A52 5G will do that for you. The TCL 20 Pro, which I looked at pretty recently, is like very snazzy looking with a curved display, kind of flagshipy. Pixel 5a is not that. It's very it is very just kind of standard and bland, but like really good.
Right.
And the software has always been like a really strong suit for it. You're going to get super fast updates, feature drops, a good length of security, update support. But that's not exciting.
Well, okay. You say there's nothing to complain about, but this is a Verge cast, so we have to. I think there's two things to complain about. One is like my hobby horse of why doesn't Google try hard to sell these things? So we got to get to that. But before we get to that, can you explain this confusion with the 5G support? Not the fact that Google like just puts up the wrong specs on its spec page on its website, which is hilarious, by the way. They just flat out got like three different specs wrong on their own website for this phone. Just, come
That's
on,
incredible.
Google.
Like, is there no copy editor at Google? Like,
I don't know.
No, it's an AI.
Oh, yeah.
No, copy and paste on Android is really hard, right? You got a long press. It's like the thing pops up. It's confusing. So anyway, but before we get to complaining about Google's insanity, what's the deal with its 5G compatibility? Because it's not perfect, right?
Yeah, there's a couple of weird things about it. The first is kind of less of a concern. There's no millimeter wave.
Right.
Last year's model, there was a separate version of millimeter wave sold through Verizon. It was more expensive. Chances are you don't have a millimeter wave signal around you, so it's not a big deal.
Right.
So that's just, they're just not doing that this year. So it's all sub 6 gigahertz. But the weird thing is the C-band support. And C-band is the good stuff that's coming, especially for Verizon and AT&T customers.
Would you say that when the new C-band stuff gets here, then we're really in a race?
The race starts, yeah. It's
okay.
Actually, no. This whole past 5 years has just been like a warm-up race.
Oh, yeah.
They were just stretching.
Yeah.
It's like in NASCAR when they do the lap before the actual start happens.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's what's been happening.
How many NASCAR races have you watched in your life?
I have been in person to one NASCAR race.
Okay.
Actually attended, camped out there. It was super fun. And I have watched... I don't know, a dozen.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah.
Way more than I have.
Because they don't always do a rolling start, but I guess only in the context of 5G.
Right.
Okay. I want to keep going with the NASCAR metaphor. I just want to make sure everyone's with me. I could keep going. I just said, maybe not.
The good stuff.
The good stuff. So that's when, allegedly, it's going to get really good in the U.S., the 5G. So that starts rolling out in December. So phones now are... It's becoming more and more common to see support for it on them because you can hold on to your phone a couple of years. You're probably going to be able to use it. So the Pixel 5a supports the right bands for C-band on the hardware level. It has the FCC certification to use C-band, but Google is doing a weird thing where they are just not committing to making the software update that it would require to use C-band. And that makes no sense.
Don't the Pixel 4s have C-band support?
The Pixel 5, I think, was one of the early phones that they're like, we're bringing C-band.
Does it just have like a wacky radio and they don't want to deal with making the driver for the modem that it happens to have or something? Like, it makes no sense to me.
I mean, they've been using this modem and radio for a little while now.
Yeah.
Seeing as it's exactly the same as last year's phone. So I don't know if that's much of an excuse.
Are they just going to like come around in 2 months and say for $25 more, you should now have C-band?
C-band plus.
What did they say when you asked them about it?
I laid out all these points. I was like, okay, so you got the hardware, you got the FCC, you're not committing to the software update. And they're like, yes. So it's like, it's really hard to imagine that they won't update, but it's sort of like, I don't want to second guess them on that. So that's kind of is what it is. Like all the facts laid out there, it has the right components and approval to use C-band. So just kind of a weird question mark on that right now.
Okay, whatever, Google.
Is this where like the Android community can get involved? Can they make C-band happen? Just some like big Pixel fans.
If enough of them buy it.
Well, yeah, if enough of them buy it. Also, the networks don't exist yet. Right. A huge part of the 5G story in America is that all of the networks are fake. T-Mobile's network is not fake. That's
even Genophysis.
The Genophysis, deeply fake. It's just like, yeah, I don't know. Anyhow, the race is great. The race is doing really well.
The last thing is, where can I buy one?
Well, Dieter, first of all, you need to live in the U.S. or Japan.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're out of luck.
Great.
And then it's not being sold through carriers this year. It's Google Store and their wireless brand. And that's it. That's where you can get it. You can't tell your uncle to go pick one up when his like 2-year contract is over at Verizon. It kind of sucks. I want to be like, this is a phone that a lot of people should buy. And it's sort of hard to track down.
Why? So actually, like the big question is, why didn't they just like cut the price on the 4A 5G or, you know, whatever, and not make this phone since they can't get it into carriers anyway? Like, and they've got the 6 coming, which is the high end one.
So they have promised to market.
Yeah, which they have promised to market. Yeah, yeah. So there's a little bit of like, why does this phone exist for Google? Which is like the perennial question for Pixel phones.
Yeah, I don't know if they want to get it out there with a new number on it, and that's going to be exciting to a small amount of people. Or, I mean, they did talk a lot about the chip shortage and supply chain constraints making this harder to distribute. So it's possible they wanted to go bigger on this and just didn't have the resources to do it. Yeah, so we kind of landed in this weird, like, limbo of it exists, but it's only in these limited channels. And yeah, sort of too bad.
It's interesting to me that Google isn't putting more of an effort on this model, and that all of its kind of hopes and dreams and plans for the Pixel line seem to be tied up with the Pixel 6, considering so far the Pixel models that have sold are the A series. Like, they're the ones that they sell a lot more of than the Pixel 4 and the Pixel 5 and so on. So you'd think if you're looking at it from like a business perspective, that maybe we put more of our effort behind the A series and we do the flagship as like an aspirational supercar, whatever. And we don't really expect anyone to buy it, but we market the heck out of the A series and that's the one that people buy. But like, they are not doing that at all, at least as far as we can tell.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just hung up on you calling the Pixel a supercar.
Maybe it will be. I don't know.
We're doing a lot of car metaphors today, and this is it's killing me.
Look, Jeff Gordon drives a supercar, or Jeff Gordon drives a Pixel 6, and then everyone buys Pixel 5As, right? That sold a lot of Ford Tauruses.
Wow. Okay. Like
just an infinity.
Neil is staring at me through the Zoom call.
The very, 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 very last Pixel thing. We have to get out this car metaphor. Although cars have battery, never. I'm not going to try and do it. The audience cared just as much about the fact that Google's not putting a wallwart charger in the Pixel 6 box as they did about this review. And it's
yeah.
like, it's, oh, yep, they're doing the same thing that Samsung has done and that Apple did first. And okay, but like everyone, I don't know, is real mad or I don't, it's, I don't know. It was obvious that this was going to happen to me.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it still just kind of stings when you feel like you're entitled to that thing.
Yeah.
You know, you paid for your phone, you get a charger in the box, and then they tell you, no, you don't get one anymore, but the phone's not cheaper. So I don't know. Maybe we just need to have a collective moment of that every time we find out that another manufacturer has taken the charger away. But yeah, it's kind of inevitable.
Will they include the cord?
They better. They have to.
I feel like we're another cycle away from them taking the cord away.
Oh, if they God. Keep the cord, I'm fine. Because like I have a little woolwart that has me like I can do like three or four cords into it. And that's what I use. I don't need extra
the cords
ones.
Are kind of consumable. Like you use a cord for a couple of years, they kind of tend to break. They yeah. wear out. They get gross. Yeah. You want it to be replaced.
The warts last forever. I have stepped on so many in my house that I just like forget I own.
Do you have a drawer?
No, I had a box.
I had to organize mine into big Ziploc bags. So USB-A, USB-C.
Oh, smart.
Well, let me just ask a question about the price here. So $450, that's good. It's competitive. It's got all the features. We're expecting a very high-end $1,000 plus Pixel 6 to come out. There's a pretty big hole in the middle of Google's lineup, right? Like $450 is, you know, just I'm assuming most people are familiar with Apple's lineup, but Samsung's lineup is the same. Like at every $50 or $100 price point, there is a phone available for you from Apple or Samsung. Google's like, here's this extremely weird set of compromises at $450. And then here's the promise of us actually trying. And Dieter, I think we're just assuming it'll be plus $1,000.
I think the Pro will be. I think that the regular Pixel 6, I've kind of been there, but I might be the only one who thinks that it could potentially cost $1,000. They might make the regular Pixel 6 a little bit less expensive, but who knows?
Yeah, it's just you had that conversation with Rick Osterloh, and he was like, "We're going to try now," and yeah. then they're like, "But not yet," right? And like, I don't know, like the rolling start metaphor is just in my brain now. Like, yep, you do the rolling start, so you're just like you're ready to go, and there's no way that this is a rolling start, right? This is just like a. They're like, well, we just got to get this thing out of the way so we can put all our attention over here.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the most popular iPhone model, it's the iPhone 12, right? Which is $700 and or $730 or $830, whatever. It's in that mid range. And then like the most popular Samsung models are their A series, which are anywhere from Allison, you know this better than I do, but what, $300 on up to $650. Mm-hmm. So like there is definitely like a gap where you could be like, well, why don't they just keep selling the Pixel 5 for $700? But then you realize that nobody's going to buy a Pixel 5 for $700 in late 2021, are they? So I don't know. They're kind of in a yeah. pickle where they got to get like a lineup going to be able yeah. to fill those gaps.
I think it's a weird gap, and maybe particularly in the US market too, because I was just writing about OnePlus bringing yet another phone not to the US. Mm-hmm. That's sort of in that like upper mid-range kind of price bracket where it's like, has several features that are like really nice upgrades from kind of the 500 mid-range. And they've just said, see ya, we're not bringing this kind of phone to the US. It's either super budget or you're going to buy a flagship. I don't know if that's like been decided for us or if we decided that.
I have a theory. Increasingly, I believe that the U.S. market is wackadoo compared to the rest of the world. And like Samsung, we're going to get into Samsung and how their S sales have just plummeted. And the big beneficiary of it, you might not realize here in the U.S. because they don't sell here really, is Xiaomi. So they have been just skyrocketing. And we just have no idea. OnePlus, they sell a few phones here in the U.S., but really they're putting a bunch of their effort in other markets. So there's something about the U.S. that makes companies not want to compete here. It's almost like the competition is hard. It's almost like there's gatekeepers, like maybe carriers or something, are trying to stop it. It's very strange.
It's fascinating.
Someone should look into that.
No comment. All right. Okay. That's a Pixel 5a coming out somehow. It's a mystery. It's a challenge, really. It's like finding a Pokemon to get it. And then, Dieter, you reviewed the Fold 3.
I reviewed the Fold 3. That review will come out next week, but I know enough to talk about it this week. And we got to get this thing done, so we're going to talk about that one. Dan's also here because he reviewed the Flip, and then I also reviewed the Watch.
Let's just knock the Watch out, because we talked about it a bunch last week, and I feel like I read the review. It's what we talked about. It's
everything we said last week was true. It is a Samsung watch for Samsung phones. And one thing I want to make clear is that's fine. It's okay that Samsung made a watch for Samsung phones. It's only frustrating because the platform it's using is the one that we know is supposed to be the good platform for all Android phones. It's just not, this is not that watch. And so I'm not saying it's inherently bad because it's a Samsung watch for Samsung phones. There are inherent problems with Samsung ecosystem, aka Bixby, but it's not the thing that people might have been hoping for, and I needed to be really clear about that in discussing it because I don't want anyone to think that they should buy this thing for a OnePlus phone or a Pixel or whatever, because you're just not going to have a good time. But if you've got a Samsung phone, go for it. It's great. You know, assuming that you trust their privacy policy, which...
I got to say, I received a lot of slacks from Dieter during the course of his review where he was like, this is nuts. And then like 5 seconds later, he'd be like, but maybe it's fine. And then like a couple minutes later, he'd be like, it's nuts.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible to read and understand.
Well, it's not only that, but I spent all weekend just pressing Samsung and these poor people were like answering my emails over the weekend, all weekend. They are end-to-end encrypting their health data. They are not sharing it with third parties. You have to be the one to explicitly do that. They do not, they say, have access to your health data unless you explicitly give them permission to look at it. But none of that information is clear on their privacy policy because their privacy policy was written to protect Samsung, you know, just in case they happen to look at something, right? Or happen to be wrong about whatever. And so I the big problem with their privacy policy isn't necessarily what Samsung does with the data. It's that Samsung isn't clear enough about what you can do to make sure that it doesn't have access to your data. Because there are ways, you know, assuming they're telling me the truth, to do that, to use their health platform and have all your data be fully encrypted and inaccessible to Samsung or anybody else. But Samsung doesn't make it clear how to do that.
That's how they get you.
Yeah.
Somewhere right now, Eric Samsung is like, Dieter's heart is beating. That's the name of the project manager.
Okay.
I don't know who works at Samsung. Okay, let's talk about the Flip. Dan.
Yes.
Is it time?
It feels like if you are buying a new phone and you're buying a new Samsung phone and you are wanting to spend $1,000 on it.
And it's the moon is in its gibbets phase.
It's in its gibbets phase. And maybe you've got a phone you're trading in. You could theoretically buy a Flip and not feel like you are making a big mistake. Like, I mean, I don't want to downplay it. It is a really big inflection point, but most of that inflection point is because they cut $450 off the price. So now the Flip 3 is $1,000, which is the same price as a Galaxy S21 Plus and an iPhone 12, and we all know that. And then on top of that, the carriers are being super thirsty with trade-in plans. Samsung's being super thirsty with trade-in plans. You can basically hand them an iPhone 3G and they will give you $500 or whatever. And you can walk out with a Flip for, you know, a very aggressive price, maybe less than a Pixel 5a. So like, you know, it's like there's a lot of incentive to buy this. But there could be a lot of incentive to buy it, and then maybe you make a bad decision. Like, there's an incentive to buy a Surface Duo at half price, but that's still a very bad decision. But the Flip 3 is, like, kind of, like, boringly good. Like, we were talking about how, like, the 5A is kind of boring. The Flip 3 is similar, which is silly to say about a phone that folds in half, but there's, like, no big gotchas with it. The price is kind of normal. The screen is really good. The processor's really fast. I had no problems with battery life. It lasted 4 to 5 hours of screen time every day. I went to bed, I had like 25% battery. So it lasted me all day long. The cameras are fine. They're not class leading. If you really care that much about cameras, you're not buying a Flip anyways. But it's like, you can now have a phone that folds in half and fits in your pocket. And the one big lingering question is that screen going to break in 6 months? And I can't answer that for you yet. Samsung is more confident than ever that it won't. And you can get it wet now, which is also kind of a nice thing that you couldn't do before. But like, where a year ago, if you were buying a Flip or a Fold or any of the folding phones, you were kind of walking into this being like, okay, I'm taking a flyer on this. It may break. It probably will break. A lot of people's broke. I'm getting like last generation hardware. I'm getting last generation cameras. I'm paying through the teeth for it. I'm not getting many discounts. I am buying this because I want to be the first person to have this phone. And now, just a year later, it's like, oh, you know, a lot of people could buy these this fall, and then a lot of people have Flips. And like, that pace of acceleration of iteration just seems way faster than I think anybody anticipated for these folding phones. And so that was kind of like my takeaway. It was like, it just felt normal. Like, it's like, oh, I could live with this. Like, this is normal. There's nothing really to complain about. If you like the idea of something that has a big screen that fits in your pocket because you can fold it in half, this is now a viable option for you.
I mean, that just sounds cool. I'm sorry. That just sounds like...
Yeah, it is very cool.
Cool as hell. Like, I know we're all like shrugging, but like, it's a phone and it folds in half.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can get it wet, which is like...
Yeah.
A pretty remarkable accomplishment. Like, I don't want to downplay that. And I don't want to downplay the fact that they put this whole package together at a price that most people would feel fine paying for a phone. Because at this point, we've established people pay $800 to $1,000 for phones all the time, right? Like, that hasn't stopped sales of the iPhone, hasn't stopped sales of anything, really. And so they brought it to this price point where it's just like, this isn't a novelty. This is normal. And that's like a kind of a pretty major inflection point for this kind of technology. Now, it could be in 6 months when all of them break, or if all of them break, that it's like, okay, that was a mistake. We're not there yet. And like, not that many people should be buying them or whatever. But like, at this stage, it's pretty wild to see, and that they've iterated this quickly. And I think this is what Samsung's really good at, is that just relentless in iteration on their idea. We saw them do it with the curved screens years ago, and we saw them do it with like the Note for years. And now we're seeing them do it at a faster pace with the folding phones. And I think there's, to Dieter's point earlier about how their lunch is getting eaten all over the world by Xiaomi, there's more incentive for them to accelerate this path of iteration. But like, I wouldn't feel too scared buying this myself. Like, if I were buying a phone, like, I can totally understand why other people might, and they want to take a beat, and it's probably smart to take a beat with any sort of new technology. But this is getting to the point where it doesn't feel like new technology anymore. It feels like normal technology.
But that's because you will buy a new phone in 6 months.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
There's like 0% chance that you're going to have a phone for a year.
I'm still the early adopter, right? And so like, but like, even last year buying one, I would buy it if I bought it. I didn't buy one last year, a Flip at least. You'd go in knowing that you're making compromises on it. And now you would go in buying it and really getting everything that you would get from a comparable $1,000 flagship smartphone that doesn't fold in half.
Do you think they rushed into it? Right. We went through the marketing cycle where Motorola was like, it's a new Razr. All the influencers come to a party. And like, Samsung was on the Today Show, and like, the products were not ready.
Yeah,
for that. Absolutely. Like, not even close. And now we're like, the product's ready, and everyone's like, oh, another folding phone. And we just like,
they totally like, you know, shot themselves in the foot a little bit. But like, if you look at like the Razr and those first, like, to that point, like, the Razr was $1,400, had kind of a lousy screen, had a mid-range processor, definitely had lousy cameras. You were buying this specifically because it folded in half and looked like the old Razr, if you bought it. Nobody really bought that phone. But like, if you were buying it, that's why you were buying it. And like, you were like, I'm going to compromise on all these other features. But now it's like, okay, I'm buying this because I like that it folds in half. And also, I don't have to compromise on the screen. And I don't have to compromise on the fact that it's water resistant. And I don't have to compromise on the processor and the performance and the battery life and all that fun stuff. And now it's just like, I can buy a folding phone that is my normal phone. And like, that's a huge point to reach, but this perception, and we think we've seen this in reaction to from the audience and everything, is that like, but I don't know, we saw a lot of them break. So like, yeah. Like there's this like huge reticence from the general public.
Well, that's why I think the $999 price point is, I don't want to give Samsung too much credit. I mean, more than anybody, I'm like, once these phones are cheap, then that's like the main thing. They gotta bring the price down. So they did it, but because they're also water sealed. The only people that can feasibly repair one of these things is Samsung, right? Mm-hmm. And so you maybe should think about pricing in the Samsung extended warranty fold protection program, whatever the heck they're calling it, into the cost of this phone. I think that would be, I know that extended warranties are a thing and they're often a ripoff and whatever, but I think it might be prudent in this case, if you think you're going to hang out of this phone for a while, to pay that extra money and price that into the cost of this phone.
Yeah, and if you pre-order it, like I said, Samsung is super thirsty to get everyone to buy these. Samsung will give you a year of that service for free. And then if you break the screen, I think it's a $250 deductible, and they will repair that screen 3 times. So if you do it, if you damage the screen, they'll do that. If you don't have that coverage, Samsung gave me some pricing on repairs. A Flip 3 costs $369 to repair the inside screen if you're out of warranty and you don't have their Samsung Care or whatever, which is not that much different than the cost to fix an iPhone 12 screen, if I remember correctly, and less than it costs to fix the back of an iPhone 12, which is always hilarious. So it is expensive to fix, and you're right, the Samsung's the only one that can fix it. You are more than likely going to be shipping your phone somewhere and crossing your fingers and hope that it comes back in a few days and whatnot. But it might be, you know, if you are that concerned about it, a lot of people buy extended, you know, protection plans. Apple Care is very popular on their phones anyways, but it might be extra prudent to do so. This is like, we mentioned that it's water resistant a bunch. It is not dust resistant at all. So in the review I wrote, take it to the pool, don't take it to the beach. Like you're going to want to be careful in that respect.
Last question, and then I want to talk about the Fold. Tell me about this cover screen. Is it good? Is it all of my dreams? Is it?
I think the cover screen is probably where they still have the most room for improvement. Like,
So not all of my dreams.
It's not.
Do your dreams involve replying to text with Bixby?
I got weird dreams, man.
Yeah, I mean, the cover screen's bigger. They had to do that. The last one was kind of a joke. So they made the cover screen bigger. You can customize the look of it with different animations and stuff, which is fun. You can put widgets on there to see your calendar and weather. And if you're playing music, you can control it with the music. And you can read notifications now. But there's no, like, quick reply messages. Like if you want to reply to a message, there's nothing like that say like, okay, or I'm on my way, or any of those canned message type of things. You have to either use Bixby voice command, which I think we all know is probably not going to work, and or B, open the thing. So the cover screen still is there as like a stopgap before you open the thing. You can't really use it without opening it. And that's one of my critiques against this design. Is that it is less convenient to use than a standard slab smartphone that you can just pull out of your pocket, one-handed unlock, and like reply to a message or make a phone call or whatever you want to do. Like you have to stop. You have to more than likely use 2 hands to open the thing. You can kind of nudge it open with your thumb, but it's hard and it'll probably fall out of your hand if you do that. And you also kind of feel like you're going to be like scratching the screen with your thumb when you do it. So you're using 2 hands to open it, unlock it, all that fun stuff. So it is a different use case than what we're used to and what we're commonly familiar with. But if you want to have a big screen and you want to have a phone fit in your pocket, you will, you know, learn to use a folding phone, I guess. I mean, like, that's kind of the trade-off that you're making.
Yeah, I just think calibrating that cover screen is so interesting, right? Like, part of the appeal of this whole thing for me is that you close it and then you're done. And the internet can't hurt you anymore. Right? Like, I'm just, goodbye all of these people.
I would want the cover screen twice as big.
But then now you're just like, now I have a little phone.
Yeah. So I have a little phone for little phone stuff.
That like leads me directly into the Fold.
Yeah, but like that's kind of what I would want, because then I can reply to a message without having to open the phone, without having to really stop what I'm doing or whatever. I can, you know, get more context or information about whatever it is I'm seeing. Maybe I can read the whole notification instead of only getting half of it without opening the phone.
But aren't you wearing a smartwatch?
I'm wearing a smartwatch. Is everyone?
Like, there's a real dance here between what's happening on your wrist, what's happening on the little screen, and actually opening the phone.
The other rub with that is they designed the interface of the cover screen to basically mimic what you can do on a smartwatch. It looks like a smartwatch's interface if you have a Samsung smartwatch.
They should have just gone all the way.
No screen.
They should have just made the cover screen the watch. They should have just taken the watch screen, the circle, and yes, the whole thing.
That'd be cool.
Separate processor.
A phone that runs two operating systems.
It would have been awesome.
I'm dead serious. They should have just done that.
It's all Android.
It's not all Android. It's like Wear Otizen or whatever it's called. That's what I want. A phone that runs two operating systems.
Absolutely, yes.
The other area they could still improve is the cameras. They kind of just went status quo with the cameras. They're the same as last year. They're not bad, but like you can get better cameras very easily from a Pixel or Samsung's own phones or an iPhone.
All right. Well, speaking of cover screens, mm-hmm. the Fold is a little Android phone that opens into an Android tablet. Like, it's hard to like escape that now, especially that they've fixed some of the tablet stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, everything Dan said about the Flip basically applies to the Fold. The resistance, the durability, maybe now's the time sort of sense of it. The spec updates here, like so fast refresh rate on the outer screen. The cameras are pretty meh. You can use a stylus on the inside screen, but it's very wobbly on a table. And it also, I don't know, it's not the Note. With the Note, part of the appeal is you can like whip the stylus out and take a quick note, put the stylus back, and you're done. With this, you have to open it up and then get the stylus out of wherever you're keeping that stylus and then start writing on the screen. But really, like, Samsung has been iterating on this idea of this form factor with the little screen on the outside, bigger screen on the inside. It's got a crease. It's got a little bit of a gap when it's closed for 3.5 generations now, maybe 4. And I don't think it gets much better without some huge technological breakthrough. I'll just warn you, Vergecast listeners, that's how I'm going to end my review. Like, I think this is as good as this idea gets, right? They could improve the cameras. They could make the stylus work on the outside. They could do some other stuff. But fundamentally, it doesn't get much better than this for this idea. And so if you like the idea of having a big tablet or a mini tablet in your pocket, and you're willing to pay $1,800 or more for it, and you're willing to have a thing that's pretty thick when it's closed, the only thing that should hold you back, besides those two things, which are very real, is, do you trust it to, you know, hold up for 6 to 8 months? Because the screen feels great. Everything about it is, like, good. The multitasking is good. It works essentially in the same way that the iPad 15 multitasking works, where you can tap a lozenge and have a button pop up. But if you prefer to drag windows around, you can. You can have 3-up in any orientation that you want. You can have pop-up windows. You can drag stuff around. It feels very, very fluid because it's using the Snapdragon 888. You can have a dock on the side of the phone if you want. There's a million options, but they're not completely overwhelming. And Samsung enabled this like Labs feature that basically makes Android apps that haven't been coded properly to work in windowing systems. Just it forces them to do it. And it works. Like, Instagram is great. I can have it be the full width of the phone. I can multitask with it, and it, like, works at different aspect ratios when you drag the sliders around to change the size of your tiled windows. The multitasking here is very good. And there's the other line from my review I'll just tell you. I feel just as weird and uncomfortable saying multitasking on an Android tablet is good as you do hearing me say it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't believe you. I've already seen the video. I was like, none of this is happening.
I mean,
Dieter green screened it.
It's very strange.
Dieter, how do you take photos with it? Like, do you open it? Do you close it? Are you like the dill hole with an iPad at the concert?
Yes, but that is great because you can do selfies with it. So, okay, there are 3 ways to take a selfie. Okay. I mean, you can take regular photos with it closed or with it open, and having it open is awesome. Don't be shamed into not taking tablet photos. Don't be shamed. You can take a selfie with the good cameras on the back. You like start the selfie mode with the close, and then you like open it up, and then you're taking a selfie with good cameras. There's a 10 megapixel selfie camera on the outside to just taking regular selfies. And then, my friends, there is a selfie camera on the inside on the big screen. It is 4 megapixels, which is terrible, but I don't care about that. Like, you just use it for video calls. If you want to take a good picture, use the good cameras. But it's a underscreen selfie camera. Samsung thought that was a good idea. Samsung was wrong. It's terrible. It looks like a screen door. It looks like the opposite of pixel density. It looks like a zit. And it, because it has that screen door effect, it's got the Moir effect. And so it draws your eye. I think I complained about this last week. It just draws your eye.
Yeah.
It's just like a magnet. It's just as bad a week later as it was when I first looked at it. It doesn't go away. And it's a huge mistake.
And you can't just like kill it so it's a pinhole all the time.
Nope. Big mistake. Like, it's like, if they made a setting to turn it off, I would be a little bit more like eager to tell people that this is the one. It's just too experimental a feature to have put on this thing. It's just dumb.
Yeah. I'm shocked. I mean, within minutes, right? Someone's going to write an Android utility that just.
Yeah, for sure. Someone will figure that Android utility out. Yeah. I mean, there's an Android utility to de-Bixby the thing. You know, you can de-Bixby any Samsung phone now. It's not too hard. If you've got a Windows computer, it actually like handles the routing for you so that it just works really, really cleanly.
And there isn't a place to put the stylus. That's the thing that's like...
It's weird, right?
Like, I feel like I should be able to close it. The stylus should just go boop right in the gap.
the gap is...
Or like in the hinge. Yes.
Well,
yeah,
there is a case like that has a stylo for it on the hinge, on the back.
No.
Which I haven't seen yet. But yeah, I mean... This gets into like, are they gonna bring the Note back? To me, the answer is, and Allison, you could actually speak to this. Like, they should just make the Note a cheap phone, right? Just bring it back. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Make it the cheap phone to compete with the other cheap stylus phones, right?
Yeah, they don't need like 20 flagship souped up, you know, phones that have like variations on the coolest and best specs. Like, just drop the Note out of there. It's fine.
I mean, people love gigantic, cheap screens. In doing tech journalism for a decade, there's only one thing I know to be absolutely true. And if you show people a big screen and then you're like, it's cheap, that will always be the most popular one. You can tell them anything. You'd be like, this one will kill your family. And they're like, is it 80 inches and $300? I'm going to risk it. Right? They're into it. And like Samsung has that opening with the Note. I think it was their flagship for so long. That, you know, the meetings are probably very emotional.
Like that one product manager who's like, this is the flagship. Eric is just sobbing because he's like, why are you taking it from me?
Yeah.
You're making it $300? Like, are you out of your mind?
He's like, remember when they used to explode? We've been through so much.
Dieter, I have one question for you on the Fold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the trajectory we've seen from smartphones over the past decade plus is that they have consolidated all of a bunch of different devices into one thing. But most people would agree that, you know, a smartphone is not a tablet. It's not a desktop or laptop computer. Does the Fold get us closer to this single device where now it's like, okay, you don't really need a tablet. You could use Dex on this thing. You don't need a computer as well. You just have this one expensive
Dex
thing that you keep in your pocket. Or are we still 2-3 generations away?
There are going to be a dozen people that do that, that like plug it into a monitor and use Dex and it becomes their sole computer and they're living in the future. I don't think that it's going to be that device. Really, the screen's just not big enough. You want a big screen for your laptop, right?
Right.
But what I will say is the moment when you're like, this phone isn't doing it, I need to go use my laptop, is like pushed way back with this thing. Because like you can do a bunch of tablet stuff with it. Like, I don't know, this is really dumb, but like PDFs are actually usable on this thing in a way that they never are, even on the biggest iPhone, right? You can actually read a PDF. Without having to scroll around and pinch and zoom and blah, 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 blah. It's just like a little page on a nice little tablet. So it's stuff like that. Like, it's all the things that make big screen phones nice. This is that times, you know, 1.5.
And you can, like, circle things with a pen.
And you can circle things with a pen. That's true.
All right. I'm going to buy this phone.
Okay.
Circling PDFs. That's, like, all I do. That's what I'm here for. All right. Before we go, Allison, you cover the carriers as well as reviewing phones for us. There's a gigantic T-Mobile data breach that kind of flew under the radar. There's a lot of other news happening this week. Tell us what's going on with T-Mobile.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. So what T-Mobile has confirmed is that about 47 million customer accounts were affected. This was a data breach where some hackers got a hold of, you know, stuff you don't want to give away, like your social security number, first and last names, driver's license, ID numbers. Yeah, that kind of thing. So it's all wrapped up in people who've applied for credit through T-Mobile. So it's current customers, postpaid, but also some former customer accounts or some people who applied for credit and just never opened an account with T-Mobile. So that is not great. And they've got a support page set up. If you were affected, you can go there and get some tips on, you know, they want you to reset your PIN and your password, and then you can get your 2-year trial of McAfee, whatnot. But yeah, it sucks. And I think, like, if you are concerned and you think you've been affected by this, like, freezing your credit is not a terrible idea. That's something they suggest on their site.
T-Mobile has a really bad track record with this, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is like the fourth one.
Yeah.
The thing that kind of killed me on their page about it is, like, so none of your financial information is out there. They didn't get your, you know, your credit card number, but social security number, maybe. It's like,
that's the one you can't change.
Yeah. They can just go get a whole other card in your name.
Right. Yeah.
Just be a different person.
Assume a different identity.
Yeah. All right. Well, our nation's carriers is always the most trustworthy actors in the entire tech ecosystem. I love it. We got to take a break. We got to fold this phone up. Huh?
Ah. Yeah.
Thank you, Alex.
I loved it.
I appreciate your concern. Dan, Allison, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We're going to talk about software lock-in for a long time when we come back. We'll be right back.
Support for The Vergecast comes from Shopify. Whether you're a huge company or a small crafter trying to make a buck off your hobby, selling online is one of the best ways to grow. Shopify is one of the top e-commerce platforms that you can use to get started. But it's not just online. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And you can sell wherever, online or with their in-person point of sale system. You can also sell more with less effort with their AI-powered tool, Shopify Magic. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. You might recognize more brands who already use Shopify, like Rothy's, Brooklinen, Allbirds, and more. Millions of entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries rely on Shopify for their e-commerce needs. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Vergecast. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Vergecast now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Vergecast.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
We're back. Like I said at the top of the show, actually, a lot of things happened today.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was like a pretty sleepy week, and then today was like a tsunami. So part of it is our fault. We published a huge piece. Sean Hollister had been working on it for months. Ever since the Apple and Epic trial was over, he has been diligently reading every email that came out of discovery in that trial and sorting them. So he put up a huge piece today that's, did he get, I ended up at 107, I think?
Yeah, over 100.
It's like 107 just like revelations from this trial. We're not going to go through all of them. You should read the piece. It's amazing. He's got all the PDFs, like all the receipts you could ever want. Like Sean's got a store. It's called the Receipt Store, and it's just receipts from Apple versus Epic. And there's like a lot. Like Steve Jobs wanted to build an iPhone Nano. Mm-hmm. He had Johnny Ive present mockups at a conference. Steve Jobs, a brilliant man, did not learn the lesson about big cheap screens. Took them a long time to learn the lesson about big cheap screens, and now they're all over it. But that's in there. Apple has like extremely tried to lock down its store. They've discussed iMessage and Android many times, and they've always returned to, we want to keep people here. They do gift cards in promotions, and we have emails proving it. They give gift cards during promotions because they want you to buy more apps and music and stuff from their stores because it makes it harder to switch. You knew this. I knew this. We all felt it. Now we've got an email that we're like, this is what we're doing. So just like an incredible amount of this going on. You should read that piece. That's one thing we did. At the same time, I would remind you that Epic is also suing Google. The case has just been burning in the background. And then today, the judge in that case ordered the complaints to be unredacted. Mm-hmm. So now we like have a clearer picture of what's going on. You just, it's like, I didn't even want to say it.
All right. I will say it. Part of the unredacted emails includes a program that Epic was complaining about inside Google called Project Hug.
Okay, so there is this project. Still not going to say it. So Epic is like, they're going to leave the Play Store. They're going to do Fortnite, right? Android's open. They can do their own store. Google, I can't believe they called it this.
PH.
Google launches Project Hug to hug the other game developers.
Yeah.
To like pay them money and give them free marketing so they won't go into Epic Store or any other store. Google seems like worried. We've got in the complaint, they're worried that Epic's going to go arrange a deal with Samsung, other phone makers, get better splits on revenue, basically have their store preloaded with Fortnite, which they kind of did with Samsung for a minute there. Mm-hmm. So part of this game, this is a quote, hug developers close and show love plan, a surge plan to throw extra love/promotion at top developers and games, including other Tencent portfolio companies, because Tencent, big investor in Epic. Basically, this amounts to, they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on secret deals with 20 developers that, quote, they had deemed risk of falling to Epic's contagion.
Contagion.
Wow.
This is all like for a plan called Project Hug.
Yeah.
This gets very dramatic very quickly.
So here's the thing that stood out to me. I mean, besides the name and whatever, the amount of money that we're talking about here, it was hundreds of millions of dollars that they paid. We've always said, you know, like Microsoft, when it was trying to get app stores going for Windows Phone, like just pay the money. And now we have a sense of like how much money often gets doled out in these deals, these backroom deals. It's a lot. The other numbers that jumped out at me was the stuff that Google was apparently worried they lose. So they're like, from the Epic Game Store, and if it, you know, other things start to, you know, contagion spreads, it could be 350 million to 1.4 billion by 2022. And then if, like, you know, the dam breaks and there's a Samsung app store and an Amazon app store and all sorts of other app stores and everybody gets traction, they were worried they could lose anywhere from $1.1 billion to $6 billion, which is just a lot more money than you maybe were thinking of in terms of scale for the Play Store.
Yeah. So notably, that this is just unredacted complaint. Nothing has actually happened in this case. They just took the blackouts of the complaint because the judge says the complaint should be unredacted. Google gave a statement to us, did not deny Project Hug exists. It's real, everybody. Google statement, these programs are a sign of healthy competition between operating systems and app stores and benefit developers tremendously. This is true. It's true. If you just had two stores, if you had Target and Walmart compete ferociously to get the best products in their stores that compete on rates. Google also controls the operating system and they make the deals with the number one vendor of phones in the ecosystem in this country. Like, it's true, but it's like also extremely a lie by omission, right? Like, it's true that programs like this are a sign of competition. They're worried about competition. They're going to spend their... But if you're Samsung, right, like you're also negotiating to merge your watch operating systems with Google's watch operating system. Like the layers of control across the entire ecosystem are like massive for Google. And they've got a war chest of money that they're clearly just spending to provide all this extra promotion in their store. So like, it's competition. Is it fair competition? Is it meaningful competition? Like, I don't know the answers to those questions. I would just point out they did not deny that it was called Project Hug. That's really my main takeaway from the story. Similarly.
Well, and also to your second point, the next thing.
Yeah, similarly, connected to that same kind of point, unredacted complaint reveals Google had a program called the Premier Device Program that gave Android phone makers a greater share of search revenue than they would ordinarily receive. Remember, they give Android away for free. They monetize it because people use Google apps and services. They see Google ads. They can give kickbacks to the phone makers on top of that. So in many ways, if you're an Android phone maker, Google's paying you to use Android. But in exchange for this higher rate of search revenue, they all agreed to ship their phones without any third-party app stores pre-installed. When I say it's like, yes, it's competition, it's like Google's working every angle it can to protect its premium status on your phone. And this is just one of those, man, it's icky, right? It's just like, Dieter, you and I have talked for years about like, every time we use one of these modern devices, like we know there's like some sequence of deals in the background.
Yeah.
That is preventing us from having like real choices. And this is, well, here is the deal.
But is this also why like a lot of that bloatware that carriers used to just shove on your phone that you hated, is that why it's gone?
I mean, that might be part of it. I mean, it's also gone just because we yelled a lot and we started buying phones that didn't have it. Like there is some effect of like consumers choosing the things that are good and rejecting the things that are bad. But the layers of sort of these, I call them kickbacks, you know, compare the Premier Device Program, you know, giving more search revenue to companies that only include one app store to, we had, was this like 2 years ago? There were a bunch of carrier deals got revealed in like France, and it was related to Google Play services and like requiring that you don't make non-Google versions of Android. And there was money spun up in that as well. So this is not Google gives away the operating system, and then Samsung or Xiaomi or whomever picks it up and then makes a phone and everybody's happy. This is a very complicated set of deals behind all of these phones.
And I think what makes this worse for Google, we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about Apple and Epic because that trial happened. But Apple and Epic, like the fight is very narrowly about the App Store, Apple's control of it, their arguments for needing to control the App Store. And, you know, that you can just fall down the rabbit hole of whether Apple can have a monopoly over the iPhone, right? Like that is a very complicated argument to understand. Some people in like Epic obviously believes it. Apple obviously uses its control in various ways that feel anti-competitive. But at the heart of it, they're like, it's our phone. Deal with it. With Google, they have all of these deals. It's their operating system that they have given away for free, that they have touted as being open, that they are proud of, you know, the amount of competition, all these other app stores. They point to all this stuff. And then there are an endless series of deals and documents where Google is controlling the ecosystem that runs on its open platform in order to benefit itself. And so just, it feels like it should be easier for Google because they can just say, well, there's another app store. But what is actually happening is they are using all of their other levers to make sure their app store is the preferred app store and really the only thing that matters on Android. And there's more evidence because the ecosystem is wider and Google has to use the other levers to maintain the control. In some ways, it feels like this whole thing will break worse for Google than it will for Apple.
Right.
Or we will hear more about how Google does it. Whereas, you know, Apple's emails are like, why would he do that? People would switch from the iPhone. And like, just like rationally, this makes sense. Like, yeah, that's like a normal thing. Google's like, we can't possibly have anyone use a different Wi-Fi stack, which is like a real thing they used to do, or a GPS stack. And then they like put the boot down on Motorola. And this is like a lawsuit they've had. And like, we've gone through this with Google before. And the fact that they have to use the control, the fact that their control is influencing a bunch of partners means that it's very obvious when they exert the control. Whereas like Phil Schiller sending Craig Federighi an email being like, ah, that's a bad idea, does not feel like an exertion of control.
Right.
We'll see. I think that, like I said, I think this one's going to be a lot wackier. Last revelation from this also revealed that Google had a gigantic plan to counteract Epic by building its own gaming division that would indeed also ship games on the Mac, which is very funny to me.
Finally, someone's going to break that one. They're going to figure it out.
It's pretty good. I don't know. They also try to horse trade with Epic to get Fortnite on Stadia. Mm-hmm. And Epic was like, no, that's not a lot. Yeah. Like I said, just a lot coming out of these two trials, a lot of emails, a lot of evidence that these companies are in fact trying to control your experience on the phone.
Yeah.
That brings us to Dieter's new segment.
Our new weekly segment. I think it has to be weekly, that we call This Week in Lock-In.
Dieter, what's happening this week in Lock-In?
Well, Tom Warren broke the news wide open of just how Microsoft is changing Windows to make it even more difficult to change your default browser away from Edge. It's
so petty.
So normally you just like, you have a pop-up, you click the one you want, you're done. And then, oh, wait, I want to change it. You like go into settings, you find wherever the default browser thing is in settings and whatever. But the way that all of these defaults work, they're like handlers, right? So like when you click a link that has HTTP or, you know, dot, dot, whatever, Twitter// or whatever, that's what tells the operating system, use this app to open that thing.
Right.
And so what Microsoft has done is instead of just having default browser for all the stuff you would want your browser to open, they make you go into settings and change each one of those handlers individually.
And also, if you don't click remember this setting, the dialog box goes away, it reverts to Edge, and then you have to like wander through the operating system to find it again.
Yeah. And just to be clear, even if you do all of this, that doesn't mean that Edge goes away, because when you do stuff with the, like, you know, Windows search or clicking links in like Windows widgets or whatever, those are hard-coded to Edge. And so Edge still appears unless you come up with some, you know, hacky workarounds, which do exist.
I feel like Microsoft should have learned from like the last time they had a big browser that they wanted to be the best and everybody use. You'd think they would have like maybe not be so aggro. I guess this is definitely less aggro, but like,
I think Microsoft is like looking at the iPhone and being like, well, they do it.
Yeah. I mean, the whole lesson here was Microsoft got slapped for browser bundling in the 90s, and then everyone was like, whew, everybody cool. Relax. And then
I will say this flies in the face of Nadella coming on Decoder and saying we're the open platform for open competition. We have a distribution advantage for Edge, but if you want anything to be a first-class citizen of Windows, that is what we're doing. That is the culture of the company.
Like, yeah.
That dude said that to me, and then I'm like looking at the screenshot. I'm like,
okay,
what happened to that idea?
This happened afterwards.
You know who else is mad about this is the head of Chrome publicly tweeting, Hiroshi Lockheimer, saying this from the company that claims to be the most open with, quote, the most choice, unquote. I hope this is just a developer preview thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because he definitely knows a guy at Microsoft who runs Windows.
Yeah.
Right? Like Panos Panay runs Windows. Like, do you remember when they made the Surface Duo and they both like followed each other on Twitter and like did a bunch of hard eyes emojis?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe they lost each other's phone numbers.
Yeah.
Well, every good breakup requires you to tweet at your ex about how she doesn't live up to her values.
Get messy. Let's see it.
There's like, okay, we pointed out just how locked in Samsung's and Apple's earbuds are to their respective ecosystems. Just go look at the chart. It's very sad. We pointed out that nobody's making good MagSafe things because Apple just doesn't make it easy to do MFI proper MagSafe things.
So in order to get a 15-watt MagSafe charger, you need a part from Apple.
Right.
And I will tell you, like, Apple has learned this lesson before. Apple's executives don't turn over.
Right.
Right? It's all the same dudes.
Yeah.
Who, like, learned the lesson from AirPlay. Now failing to apply what they learned to MagSafe. So if you will remember the first versions of AirPlay, there were no AirPlay speakers. They just didn't exist. Thomas Ricker wrote about this in like 2012 for us. He would like wander the halls of CES and be like, do these speakers support AirPlay? And then people would look sad at him. And eventually, well, someone told him that the reason nothing supported AirPlay was to make AirPlay work, you needed to buy a single supplier piece of hardware that was blessed by Apple. And it was so expensive and it didn't work and it wasn't small, so nobody used it. Years later, Apple's like, crap, our TV strategy has failed. AirPlay 2 will now be everywhere. They re-engineered AirPlay to support video on all the TVs that wants it and to make it easier for basically anything to have it. Now, everything has AirPlay 2. When we publish a story about a device that doesn't have AirPlay 2, everyone's like, this thing is DOA.
Yeah.
I want AirPlay 2. I wouldn't even consider it. And it's like, well, have you taken a step back, Eddie? Just thought about what happened here?
Like, he might be too busy with podcasts.
I don't know if it's Eddie. I'm just doing E names today.
Didn't the same thing happen with the Lightning cable? Because the original Lightning cable, didn't it need like a very specific Apple approved part? And so all the other ones would like melt and were terrible and people were complaining about it. And then Apple.
Even Apple's own Lightning cables melt and are terrible.
No, but it had a controller in the cable. It was definitely a thing.
Yeah. And then eventually they're like, oh, we can't keep doing this because everybody keeps yelling when they buy the much cheaper cable and it breaks and they're mad at us and we should stop that. Like, Apple knows they don't have to do this.
You know how when there's a big tech event, we have like a plan, we have like a template and, you know, we customize it and blah, blah, blah. Like, we're like, okay, there's another tech event. They're going to announce some stuff. Let's get ready. And we know how this is going to go. We know the order that it's likely to be announced. We know like how the event will go. There'll be a live blog. We know we'll need to do like, you know, this, that, the other thing.
Wait, we plan these things? I just show up.
You just show up. We do all the work. Alex actually does the work now.
It's just Dieter and I in a huddle.
I'm just like, I'm here to be charming.
Yeah. We know like what the week looks like, right? The event, the announcements, the like analysis, the like devices show up a week later, you review the things and blah, 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 blah. We've got like a 2-week game plan that we just know how it's going to go.
Yeah.
Do you think Apple has like a 3-year game plan for each one of these like technologies that like they just know how it's going to go?
Yeah.
We're going to release a thing. It's only going to work with our stuff. We say it'll work with other stuff, but it really won't. And then like a couple will work with a couple of partners just so that we can say that it does. And so Logitech and Belkin will make a thing. And then 6 months later, blah, 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 blah. And then 2 years later, we'll redo it again. So it's actually open this time. They just have a playbook.
But what's the gain from that?
They get 2 years of exclusivity.
Where the gain is, everybody buys Apple accessories, which are enormously high margin when they buy the new phones.
Okay.
The gain is people, and this is like, you weigh it, you decide how important you think this is. But Apple's like, we can't guarantee safety if we just like open this thing up and let people charge it the full 15 watts. They'll buy bad chargers and their phones will explode. I've heard this from them a handful of times. I don't know. Like maybe you believe that, maybe you don't. But that's the thing that they say. And then I think the final gain is they want to control the ecosystem. What they want is the line out the door of accessory manufacturers waiting to pay the money. And then a huge, vibrant ecosystem of people going through their toll booth. And what actually happens is people tweet crazy shit from Alibaba at me and say, this ecosystem is fine. And I'm like, I hope your family is safe. And then like somewhere down the line, Apple like gives in and like they will bless more products with a cheaper rate or something. And the entire made for iPhone ecosystem is full of people who are terrified. They will not talk. Haim Gartenberg has been trying to report out the story of how MFI really works for 10 years. Right. He's been talking to accessory makers. They talk to him off the record. But like we can't get that story out of his brain and onto TheVerge.com because everyone's like, no, no, no. I'm afraid my entire business will tank if Apple thinks I'm violating the NDA and they yank the business will disappear. Mm-hmm. So like the amount of control that Apple exerts over this ecosystem is like out of control. That said, it is at the end of the day, Qi charging and magnets. There are lots of devices that work with it. The one that's the funniest to me is like Belkin makes a stand that does 7.5 watt Qi charging with magnets because you can't lock out magnets. It's like a line that Haim's like, this is the most open standard in the world. Anyone can build a magnet. But if you don't have the software, if you don't have the little hardware chip, the iPhone software will lock you out at 15 watts. So they have a different one that's 15 watt MagSafe.
Right.
Two products in the same from the same company that look identical, with one has more expensive, here's a different part in it. That is ridiculous.
Yep. And then I don't know how much we want to get into this because you don't want to hear me complain about RSS much, but Ashley had an incredible story about what a mess Apple's podcast subscription platform has been. Everyone has to upload their podcasts to Apple separately and like deal with their fields, and they're really complicated and everybody inevitably screws it up, and like podcasts are disappearing. People are losing like 30% of their listenership just from like technical error. That's real businesses. Just whoops. Oh well.
My favorite part of this whole story. Anytime we do a story that has a good like dumb file format in it, I'm like, we accomplished our goal. Like, this is what we founded The Verge for. It's like, we're going to do two paragraphs on how the real problem here is a file format. So you use Apple's tool, you upload to their service, you pay their cut when people subscribe in their app. And then if you want any data about how this is going, there's not like a nice dashboard. There's like a gzipped Excel file in like, no, like all these podcasters, like, I don't know, man, I solve crimes. Like, I don't know what this is. Yeah. So like all these people are getting this data in this file format that they have no idea how to access or read really. And then no idea what to do with in the data. And Apple's just like dumping CSVs on the podcast industry and being like, see, we're doing great. And it's like Apple, it's getting to the scale now. And we'll talk about Facebook in a minute, but like Facebook has been a platform company for a long time. YouTube has been a platform company for a long time. And like, if you listen to Neil Mohan and Decoder, like platform company executives, they know that they have to be very careful in how they like address their audience about what the platform is going to do, because they've just been taking the hits for a decade and they have to build the tools. Actually, one of the things Neil said to me about how YouTube makes decisions is he's like, on the back end, when we provide data to YouTubers, we think carefully about where in YouTube Studio it will be, right? Do we want to put it on the first screen or the second screen? Do we want to walk people to an understanding of the data they're seeing? And that's like the kind of product review he's in. Apple's like, the podcast industry depends on our app. We're doing paid subscriptions. Here's an Excel file. And like, they just don't have the muscles to serve that kind of audience yet. And as they start to do things like make TV shows, they're going to like run into all these other kinds of problems. The child protection stuff, they're running into this problem where their standard way of talking, which is to not say anything and just like ship another iPhone and be like, what more do you want from us? Like, it's just like running into the stuff the other platforms are good at.
And I think that they maybe blinded themselves, or we just assumed they would be okay at this, because iTunes has been the default directory of all podcasts since forever, right? It's like, that is a place where you know you can find everything. It's the place where the podcasts have just gone, right? You might put yourself in other apps or other directories, but the thing is, being the default directory of all podcast feeds, literally it's just an iCloud folder full of text files. That's it. It's just RSS feeds that people upload to Apple, and they update the, you know, the latest one when they put up their new thing. It's just a big ass directory of text files that they use to build, you know, their like public facing podcast directory off of. And, you know, sure, it's more complicated than that, but the actual like podcasts themselves are hosted someplace else. And so the switch to subscriptions, part of the deal here, it's the same deal with Spotify, you know, needing to monetize, is they need to move away from that very simple RSS XML format so that they can start collecting more data about which ads you listen to and when they get inserted and et cetera, you know, how long you listen to the things and so on and so on. And so that has been the big overarching story of what's happening to podcasts over the last year, is everyone's trying to dump the format, replace it with something that's smarter. But it turns out when you dump a simple universal format that anything can use and go to something smarter, you also happen to introduce lock-in.
Yeah. That's happening in like two ways. Like, I don't think people love Spotify's podcast player. They're yeah. The other player in this. If you're listening to this in Spotify, thank you. I appreciate you. Please listen to the ads at half speed. But people, the feedback we get is like Spotify's podcast experience is like fine, not great. People right. like Apple's podcast experience until this last update. Now they hate it. But what both companies are trying to do is get basically exclusives on podcasts. Spotify is literally buying them. Apple saying, well, everyone's already in our app. Just have them subscribe here. Now they belong to us. Upload your audio to us and we will deliver it to them.
Right.
The flip side of this is like right now, if you're listening to this in Overcast or Podcast or something, yep, there's a directory of RSS feeds, like Dieter said. That directory points you at the Vergecast, which is served by our hosting provider, Megaphone, which is owned by Spotify.
Damn it.
That's the way it goes. But there are other hosting providers. Those hosting providers spit out a bunch of metrics. They're competing to provide better metrics and ad integrations. And then there's an ecosystem of companies around them that like will sell you other podcast metrics and ad integrations, all this stuff. And you see the stack is like, yep, there's a stack of providers that will help you record a podcast. There's a stack of providers that will help you monetize a podcast. There's a stack that will help you distribute it. And then there's like two endpoints in Apple and Spotify. And then the other podcast players are much smaller. Apple's just trying to like eat up that chain and they're not doing a good job. Spotify's trying to eat up that chain and they're not doing a great job. And like they could do a good job, but they're so confident that because they own the last link in the chain, they don't have to. And that's like always the problem for me. Okay, we got to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about Facebook getting sued in VR. That's a good mashup. We'll be right back.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Okay, we're back. Two pieces of Facebook news today, and I promise you they happened simultaneously for a reason, right?
Like, sure.
Yeah.
If you remember, the Federal Trade Commission and a collection of states all sued to break up Facebook and Instagram, WhatsApp. Their complaints got tossed out. The states, go away, you're done, too late, you had your chance, you blew it in 2011 or whatever. Judge says to the Federal Trade Commission, which was under the previous chairman, the Trump-appointed chairman, hey, you forgot to make the case that Facebook is a monopoly. Like the quote was like, this whole thing feels like everyone thinks Facebook is a monopoly, therefore it is. Let's break them up. Like you got to make the case that they're monopolizing something here. And so he dismissed it. Today was the deadline for the FCC to refile that case. In the meantime, right, Joe Biden appoints Lina Khan to be the chairman of the FTC. Lina Khan does not like Facebook and Amazon. Facebook asks the FTC to make Lina Khan recuse herself from this case. I don't know why they thought that was going to work. She's like, no, I'm in charge of the thing. Her response in this refiled complaint today is, well, there's a judge. Like, my job is to sue you. Your job is to defend yourself. And the judge will decide, not me.
Right.
Like, you're going to get your due process. Like, but my job is to sue you. So that's her whole response. And then lays out this, like, scorching right, refiled complaint, Russell wrote it up, but scorching definition of what she thinks the relevant market is. If you think about it, the judge basically said, you didn't do this part right, do it better.
Yeah.
So they did that part way better. The definition is very narrow, personal social networking, and the complaint tries to explain why, like, TikTok is not a competitor to Facebook because it's not about your friends and family.
Right.
And, like, why Reddit isn't, and YouTube is really just a video distribution platform. And so the whole point is Facebook is about your friends and family.
Right.
And then it's like Twitter is there to help users keep up with the news. And I'm like, no, I made some friends on Twitter. Have yet to make any family on Twitter. This is happening today. And everyone knows it's going to happen today because it's the last day.
Right.
You got to do it today. All indications are today. So then this morning, our man, Marky Z, shows up on CBS with Gayle King and announces Facebook has built conference rooms in VR. It's called Facebook Horizon Workspace. And they do the interview in VR on CBS this morning. It's like,
yeah,
it's hilarious. Alex Heath wrote it up. We've got some clips of Zuck and Boz from Facebook talking about it. In VR. I used it today. I've got a Quest 2. I like plugged it in. Like, what's really funny about it is if other people don't have VR headsets, there's like fake Zoom in VR. So like you're sitting in a virtual conference room and you're like a cartoon avatar.
And there's just like a dude.
Sean Hollister is like on a screen, like on a fake TV in VR in front of you. It's hilarious. The whole thing is hilarious. Alex, I'm going to make us start doing our meetings.
I've got my Quest 2. I'm ready to go.
Let's disclosure, I'm not saying anything about any of this ridiculous stuff because my wife works for Facebook.
He's just listening.
Yeah. But anyway, it was just a very naked, like, it's a cool product. It's worth talking about, right? We had Zuckerberg talking to Casey on the Vergecast a few weeks ago about the metaverse and this long range plan to get there. This is but one more step. It's a good flashy demo.
And he's been like promising VR office meetings for like years at the Oculus developer conferences.
Yeah. I mean, like, the, you know, Facebook executives insist that they have all their meetings in VR.
I refuse to believe that.
Yeah, that's good question.
That's not true.
That's, you can decide in your heart whether Zuck is really doing all his meetings in VR. But they say it's better. I'll say that in my 15 minutes in VR today doing a meeting, I like thought it was really weird. It's just a really weird way to, like,
how does it feel to be a cartoon?
Super weird. Yeah. Here, can I just say this?
Yeah.
Every time any software product is like, make an avatar of yourself, I have a moment of pure crisis where I'm like, I don't know what my nose looks like. Shut up. Like, what are you saying? Pick your eyebrows. When is the last time I considered the shape of my eyelashes? No, I don't know what I look
just
like.
Just in a mirror.
Yeah.
Like, what? Pulling your Oculus Quest headset off over and over again to reference yourself.
It's such a weird demand. It keeps coming up. Like, I have the new Madden. It's like, make an avatar of yourself. It's like, why? Where is this going to be useful?
Do you play in Madden as yourself?
You can. I don't because, first of all, I was very flattering to myself when I made my Madden avatar. That dude is jacked. But it's just every time something asks me to make an avatar of myself, I'm like, I don't know, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Same.
Beard guy. Can I just pick a beard guy? It'll be fine. Everyone will know what I'm talking about.
Just lady with glasses. Go.
On this screen in workspace where you're making the avatar, there's this incredible disclaimer. It says, all product features might not support legs. Just an incredible, it's like, wow. Well, that's a real problem, isn't it?
That's okay.
And like, it's funny because when you're sitting at the table, you don't see anyone's legs.
Yeah.
So like, no product features support legs.
None.
But you can turn around, you can go to a whiteboard behind you. So, I mean, like, the actual product in use, technologically amazing. So you sit down, you're in, like, if you've ever used an Oculus, like, it can, you know, it has pass-through mode. So you can kind of see a grainy black and white around you.
Yeah.
So you tell it where your desk is. You, like, draw a box over your real desk.
Right.
It can detect your keyboard. You tell it what model of laptop you have.
Oh, no.
You're like, I have a 16-inch space gray MacBook Pro.
Does it support mechanical keyboards?
It's like
trouble.
All the way to the bottom of the list. You're like, I'm a mechanical keyboard nerd. So you can tell it what model, and it will detect your laptop. It will place your laptop in VR.
Incredible.
And then you can say, I want a whiteboard. And you can get up and walk to another part of your room and pass through. Draw a whiteboard, like a big virtual whiteboard. And then when you're sitting, you get pass-through of just your desk, so you can see all the stuff on your real desk.
Yeah.
You can see where your laptop is. And then, incredibly, because it's a conference room, you need to have a laptop dongle.
Oh,
there's
sure.
an app you can run on your laptop, Oculus Remote Desktop, that will mirror your laptop display in, like, you know, full res in front of you in VR. So you can type in your laptop, you can see what's happening on your laptop, look around this conference room, and then push a button, walk somewhere else, and, like, draw on a whiteboard with a controller.
That's cool.
All this is nuts, right? And, like, your laptop hates this. Like, it's like, the fan's running.
Just, is it a jet in my house? No, it's just my laptop.
And it's just like, all of this is like technically stunning.
Yeah.
Right. All of it is also extremely distracting because the hand tracking is like Yeah, it's like a beta. So like your hands are like flying, like cartoon hands are just flying all over
just
the place.
Just flying over your head while you're trying to type.
And everyone else is just like, they're video conferencing like normal human beings, just taking screenshots of your cartoon, just like freaking out all the time.
Just Sean staring at you. It's incredible.
It's entertaining is what I would say. I don't know that we should actually have meetings in it yet, but I was very entertained by playing with it today.
Get the Quest 2s out to everybody. It'll be great.
The Quest 2 is like, I've said it on the show many times. Like, it is a remarkable product. It is like a complete, excellent consumer product that happens to be made by a company with a litany of other problems. But it is a remarkable thing that exists.
I use mine like almost every other day. I adore
it. What do you use it for?
I use it for Supernatural.
Oh, yeah. Supernatural's great.
It's fantastic. I love it. I use it all of the time. I hate that I have to like use Facebook. Like I hate that like Facebook is a part of it, but I love everything about it. One day I will finish playing like the Jurassic Park game. It got too scary for me. I had to stop. Too many dinosaurs.
I tried to play the one where you're in a space station and something bad happened to you. And I was like, I'm very nauseous. And also I don't like these kinds of games. Okay, so that's Facebook. They were successful, right? I spent more time talking about VR than their antitrust complaint. Facebook, for its part, says the antitrust complaint will fail. The thing's already been dismissed. They tend to believe that the market definition is still too broad, that they have a lot of competitors. I think they have a pretty good case to make that Facebook actually competes with a lot of different things. Like TikTok is a real competitor to Facebook.
Right.
Is it the kind of thing that Facebook is? It is not.
I mean, that's why they just launched Reels today, too, right?
Reels in actual Facebook.
Yeah, or in the United States. So, like, they know it's a competitor.
Yeah, I think the thing people will say is it is ridiculous to think that the market for all things is just attention, full stop.
Yeah.
Like, there are different kinds of products that occupy your attention in different ways. And if you just define the market as attention, then everything is competitive with everything all the time.
Can I disclose, but I just want to point out that as part of my full Z Fold 3 review, I opened up a split screen with TikTok on the left and Instagram Reels on the right. I just had that experience for 20 minutes.
That's incredible.
It's amazing.
Just go.
And like sometimes it felt like they were interacting with each other. Like there was like the bad knockoff reel on the right and the good TikTok on the left.
Oh, that's
like,
really good.
Yeah, it was really solid.
Just content being piped into your eyeballs.
All right, we got to wrap this up. But Alex, there's a lot of Intel GPU news this week. You want to just take us through real fast?
Yeah, a lot of things happened. Not a lot, actually. What happened is every year, Intel does like three pre-announcements. Like I think Google is just like taking from their playbook with the Pixel 3, where they're like, this is coming. And then like later on, it'll be like, okay, it's finally here. So yesterday, I believe, they had this big thing. They invited all the journalists and stuff. Heimgartenberg went and listened in on everything. And they announced that the Alder Lake chip, which is like a new CPU that's on Intel 7, which is not 7 nanometer, but 10 nanometer because it's Intel. And it's actually kind of a cool chip because it's trying to compete both with like Apple and all the ARM-based stuff that Apple's done that's really, really good at battery, and also trying to compete with AMD and Ryzen, which is really, really good at power. And so it's saying, okay, we're going to start doing big and little cores, essentially. They're going to have like an efficient core and a power core and merge them together in this chip. And it's going to be really, really good at battery life and also really, really fast. Not a whole lot of details beyond that, especially on things like numbers, like how fast. They were crucially comparing it to some older CPUs because they always do that. Every time they're like, it's 70% faster than this CPU from 7 years ago. So we still don't know a lot about it, but it's just neat. It's just neat that they're thinking a little bit outside the box, because for like the last 5 or 6 years, Intel's whole plan has been, we're going to make this 14 nanometer chip just more and more and more and more and more efficient. And so now they're having to actually do like some weird, cool architecture stuff. And there's some really cool architecture stuff happening there. Haim did a fantastic kind of breakdown of it. Highly recommend you go read it. He also learned all about their new GPU, which they announced like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a little closer now. So this time they were like, okay, we're going to now talk about like the name of these GPUs, and specifically it's called, hold on.
Arc.
Arc. Well, it's called Arc. It's the stupidest name in the world because, like, it's like the architecture this time is called Alchemist.
Ooh. Okay.
And then later there's going to be Battle Mage, just in case you were concerned about, like, where we're coming. And then Celestial, and then finally Druid.
Okay.
So this is like the next 3 or 4 years, I think, of this roadmap of architecture.
But they're promising that they're gonna be like selling to consumers. And this is where I get a little bit stuck, because new chips, they sell through blah blah blah. But like, what has Intel successfully sold directly to consumers in recent memory? Like, they just canceled RealSense. Not that that really was ever meant for consumers. Like,
they sell CPUs.
They sell, like, that's it, right? Everything else they've not been able to do. And so is selling a GPU close enough to selling a CPU that they'll be able to pull it off or not? I mean,
they assume so, right? Like, they think that they're going to do it because they look at AMD, who has a much, much smaller market share. And they're like, well, AMD did it, can do it, and is very quickly coming for us in a lot of different spaces. And so we're going to do it too. And like, the interesting thing is the money for them isn't in these GPUs that they're selling to consumers, like the Alchemist and the Battle Mage and stuff. That's not where they're going to make money. They're trying to really compete, not with AMD, but with NVIDIA in the server space, in the enterprise space, because NVIDIA is just like taking everybody to school when it comes to these big GPUs that everybody needs for AI processing. And so that's like, that's what Intel's actually trying to do. But they're also like, oh yeah, and also we're going to do like GPUs for everybody else, and we'll be able to package it together like AMD, and it's going to be super great, and you're going to love us, and we will continue to be the biggest name here, even though we've sat on our laurels for so long. They rotted. We fell.
Rotted laurels.
Like, it's, right, on laurels rot.
I mean, like they are literally organic, you know.
Yeah, they probably rotted. And, like, Intel has just really screwed up for years and years, really, like, didn't pay attention to their competitors and where their competitors were going, and is now quickly trying to play catch-up. And maybe they'll do it. You know, these GPUs they're saying are really fast.
Maybe they'll do it, the Intel story.
They're providing some cool, like, software solutions the way that NVIDIA does with like DLSS. So they're kind of their own competitor to that in the works, and something that they do really well that AMD has really struggled with and only kind of caught up in the last year or so is that software integration. Like, they're really good at integrating the software and making all the different parts of a computer work together well. So it could be a real viable competitor to AMD and NVIDIA, but we'll have to see when it actually comes out, because we still don't know enough about it to like actually know anything besides neat.
I mean, I feel like the Intel story is like, Intel, you're going to love us again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to be fair, they have a new CEO
who
I've been trying to get on Decoder for months.
Pat, come on. Talk to Neelai, please.
We've been doing Decoder for almost a year, and like the push and pull of getting CEOs to show up in the show is like very interesting. Like, everyone wants to come in riding on the high, and I want everyone to come in when they're the most embattled. Right, because the most interesting question is, how are you going to fix it, right? I think they're waiting.
And, like, the thing is, all of this stuff that's happening right now, he didn't really have any part in. Mm-hmm. Like, this was all in process for years now. And so his thing is, like, some of the other moves he's been making with, like, making deals with smaller manufacturers to produce their chips and stuff like that. Like, that's where he's coming from.
And begging the government for money.
Yeah.
Yeah, and begging the government and being like, look at all this stuff we're doing in Arizona to compete with China. Yeah.
Which Justine Kalma has written a very good article about how both Intel and TSMC want to build these chip factories, but there's a giant water shortage and chip factories require a ton of water.
Yeah.
So my first question is, why are you building a chip factory in the hot, dry place? But it turns out that there's a lot of sun, which is very good for solar power, for powering these factories. And also because they just have like built up a little industry, little parts of the world end up randomly being good at certain kinds of industries. And Arizona is randomly good at, you know, making chips and having, you know, chip experts at the university and whatever. But this water crisis on the West Coast is getting very real, and it's going to be very real for Arizona. And I don't know how viable it is to be wanting to build lots and lots of gigantic water-dependent chip factories out there. Anyway, Justine's story is great. You should read it.
Yeah, go read it. I think she does a really good job of explaining the issue. And, you know, I think it's really about, like, there's that initial cost of water for these companies, but they've gotten really, really good at recycling that water and reusing it and stuff. So they've got like giant pools, basically, that, and it's just, they fill it up. And so that initial thing is going to be, it may take longer, who knows, but yeah, go read her story. It does a way better job explaining it and just fantastic work.
Can I just point out that Intel, TSMC, real companies, the real product with a shockingly huge demand, cut sweetheart deals with Arizona to build their chip factories. They want to cut additional sweetheart deals. They built a network of suppliers and a talent base in a state that didn't have it before.
Yeah.
A critical component is water, but they've got a plan to get water in the desert. And Foxconn built a factory in Wisconsin with no products on the roadmap and built no labor base, but managed to literally build a pipe from the Great Lakes to their empty building.
Yeah.
She's killing me here, man.
I have a solution. We're coming up on the end of the Vergecast, and I think I know what needs to happen because it's the end of the Vergecast that just came to me. I think that they should make O-RAN. The Foxconn factory in Wisconsin should make O-RAN chips for Gen5sys.
A Japanese carrier called Rakuten literally put out a brochure this week that has been tweeted at me numerous times. It's like, O-RAN's real. Our network runs on it. And I'm trying to figure out why they put out this lengthy blog post. And I can only surmise that someone there is listening to our show. Because, like, who are you convincing except for the eight people who make it to the end? And they're like, I'm skeptical about O-RAN.
Just whispering to Dieter.
I'll send it to everyone. Okay, I want to end on this piece of news. It's my favorite piece of news from the week. It really sums up a lot. Mm-hmm. About the largest companies in America. GM and AT&T have announced a plan to bring 5G to Chevy, Cadillac, and GMC vehicles by 2024. You're doing great, guys.
Wow.
We won't be halfway through the 6G hype cycle. It's amazing. Okay, that's it. We went long. We did it.
Yeah.
I'm proud of us.
Yeah.
We love hearing from you. You can tweet at us. I'm at Reckless Dieter's at Backlon. Alex is Alex H. Kranz with a Z. Dan is DC Seifert. Allison Joe 1. Thanks again for coming on. Decoder next week. Gonna be a good one. Doug DeMuro.
Oh, shit.
YouTube car reviewer. We got into it.
Hell yeah.
Yeah?
Man, talks some smack.
Did you talk about the quirks and features of his business?
We talked a lot about the quirks and features of his business. If you are interested in being a YouTuber, you've got to get good at Excel. That's what I'm going to tell you. And he talks a lot about what he tracks and how he thinks about things. But he also just like talks some smack. It was great. It's going to be a great episode. That's coming on Tuesday. We'll be back next week with more Vergecast. I'm assuming more. We're like the news is coming, right? End of August into fall hardware season.
Oh, it's going to be.
Get ready.
4-hour Vergecast. Get ready.
It's never going to stop. That's it. Rock and roll.
Get a vaccine.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.